It's the Sound Kitchen.
Mmm, yummy.
It's the Sound Kitchen.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
You're listening to the Sound Kitchen.
Yummy.
And Susan Owensby's cooking.
Bienvenue and welcome to the Sound Kitchen, where you never know what you'll be served. I'm Susan Owensby. It's Saturday, the 29th of March, the 88th day of the year in the Gregorian calendar. There are 277 days left until the end of the year. This was a big week in Bangladesh. Wednesday, the 26th, was the country's Independence Day. There was a nice letter in the Sound Kitchen mailbag from Sultan Sarkar, the president of the Shetu RFI Fan Club of Bangladesh, with his thoughts on the 54th anniversary of his country. Here's his letter. Hello to all friends and listeners of RFI. I want to express my deep respect and gratitude to the fearless heroes who sacrificed their lives to snatch the red sun of Bangladesh's independence in 1971. The sacrifices of those who liberated this country are forever remembered. Bangladesh is a neglected country on the world map. Here, people have had to struggle repeatedly for basic human rights and democracy. In early June of last year, led by the Students Against Discrimination, we had a pro-democracy uprising which began as a quota reform movement. After government forces carried out mass killings of protesters in July, the movement escalated into a full-fledged mass uprising when the general population joined in. We call it the July Revolution and the Student People's Uprising. We were able to oust then-Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who fled to India. We formed an interim government with Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus as the chief advisor. We are dreaming of a discrimination-free Bangladesh, a country where all citizens enjoy equal opportunities, rights, and dignity. A society develops only when justice, equality, and human values are established. We hope to ensure equal opportunities for all in education, health, employment, and social security, where there is no discrimination between rich and poor, where the rights of men and women are equal, and where every person has the opportunity to live with dignity. Let's build a developed and non-discriminatory Bangladesh based on honesty, justice, and humanity. Happy Independence Day, Bangladesh. Kind regards, Sultan Sarkar. I hope you all had a great Independence Day and we're with you in your dream and hard work for building a discrimination-free Bangladesh.
Bonjour, I'm Tandra Tabasum from Bangladesh. I am 5 years old. I listen radio from every day.
The Sound Kitchen team is complete. Erwan Rome is at his mixing board behind the glass window in front of us. And our co-chef, Paul Myers, also known as Baby Brother, is right here next to me. Say hello, Baby Brother.
Hello, big sister.
Hey, sports guru. Hey, my sports guru.
It's here. This is extra payment.
Okay. I am so jazzed about Kirsty Coventry's election as president of the International Olympic Committee, mainly because she's vowed to try and get financial help to young athletes. Well, also because she's the first woman to have the position and the first African. It's all great. Did you ever see her swim?
I was there in Beijing when she won her second gold medal, the backstroke. She got the first in 2004 in Athens. So I saw her swim to get that gold. I can't remember. Yeah, she was in London as well. But I saw her races back in Beijing a long time ago. And I haven't really followed her career after she gave up, but obviously Minister for Sports in Zimbabwe, you've got to know how to handle the politics there. And a very interesting appointment, because of course everyone's unhappy apart from the people who win. And there's all kinds of stories about all these backroom deals. But she got 49 of the 98 votes in the first round. And everyone was expecting the whole voting process to be quite long-winded, you know, round after round. But she swept the board. And really, that's fantastic, because if you look at a list of all the former presidents of the International Olympic Committee since 1894, it's a lot of men. It's not a lot of men, it's only men.
Exactly.
And even just out of embarrassment, she should have won. But her idea of giving money to the youngsters growing up, because that comes from personal experience when her mum and dad had to go out and sell hamburgers to fund her development. So, yeah, there's a lot of emotion in that. So good for her.
I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
Okay, so off we go. Still to come, the quiz, your answers to the bonus question on the Listener's Corner with Paul, and a tasty musical dessert from Erwan on Music from Erwan. So don't touch that dial.
Are you ready? I do hope so.
And so do I, cuz it's time for the quiz. First of March, I asked you a question about the UN General Assembly vote on Monday, the 24th of February. You were to reread our article, French President Macron set to brief EU leaders over details of Trump talks, and send in the answer to this question. With which country or countries did the U.S. align its votes at the UN General Assembly meeting on Monday, the 24th of February? Paul, what's the answer?
To quote our article, as the talks between Macron and Trump were taking place, the U.S. sided with Russia in two votes at the United Nations to avoid condemning Russia's campaign against Ukraine, a shift from the stance of the previous U.S. administration. The resolution, co-sponsored by Ukraine and European Union countries, condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine and called for the immediate withdrawal of Russian troops. The US vote marked a significant policy shift, as the country aligned with Russia, Belarus, and North Korea in opposing the resolution. The resolution was adopted with 93 votes in favour, 18 against, and 65 abstentions. Countries that abstained included India, China, and the United Arab Emirates. The second vote was a US-introduced resolution which did not mention Russian aggression and called for a swift end to the conflict. This resolution was adopted after an amendment proposed by France acknowledged Russia's invasion. The amended US resolution received 93 votes in favour, 8 against, and 73 abstentions, with the US abstaining from the final vote on its own resolution. In addition to the quiz question, there was the bonus question. What was the breaking point that made you quit a job? You'll hear the answers later in the Listener's Corner, so please do stay with us.
The winners of this week's quiz are RFI English listener and a brand new one, Jocelyne Dericot. Jocelyne is from Paris, but now lives in New Zealand. Jocelyne is also this week's bonus question winner. She wrote about her unhappy teaching experience at the Lycée Français in Los Angeles in the early 1980s, where she broke her year-long contract at the six-month mark. Listeners, the French government has a system of schools in many countries throughout the world called lycée français. They're for the children of French citizens living outside of France. They follow the French national curriculum and are open to everyone, but only the tuition of French nationals is subsidized by the government. Other nationalities must pay full tuition. Jocelyne wrote, the directors of the school received a subsidy from France, as well as private payments from very wealthy individuals in the entertainment industry, this being LA. I was given a list of individual students to whom I was always to give an A or A+, the highest mark, despite them being bad students. I thought it wasn't fair that rich people should get an undeserving A when the students who were studying hard were not getting any recognition because their tuition was subsidized. It was clear that the lycée wanted to keep the wealthy people who were paying higher fees. If that wasn't enough, I then had a student say to me, if you don't give me A's all the time, I will kill you. I have a knife. That was the breaking point, the point of no return. Although I didn't want to compromise my values of fairness and justice, I also just wanted to stay alive. Yeah, Jocelyne, I guess so. We have that same type of inequity at U.S. universities and probably just about everywhere where education is monetized. In the U.S., some kids are let in as legacy candidates, which means, in general, their parents gave a lot of money to the university. Totally not fair, but they do have to pay full tuition, which does allow universities to have the cash to offer scholarships to less economically favored students. It's a sort of Robin Hood arrangement, you see. It may be something of the same reasoning for the lycée français, but I don't at all know how it works. At any rate, congratulations on your double win, and thanks for joining us in the Sound Kitchen. Also on the list of lucky winners this week are Ferhat Bezazel, the president of the RFI Butterflies Club Ain Kachera in West Skikda, Algeria, and Nafisa Khatun, the president of the RFI Mahila Shrota Sangha Club in West Bengal, India, who wrote a lengthy answer to the quiz, some of which Paul quoted. Good work, Nafisa. Last but assuredly not least, there are RFI English listeners Shihab al-Islam from Naugaon, Bangladesh, and Rimal Paul from West Bengal, India. Congratulations to this week's winners, and thanks to each and every one of you who wrote in. You've heard about the worries of the French wine industry. People are drinking less wine. Sales are down, and so are exports. And with 200% tariffs threatened by U.S. President Donald Trump, you can imagine the hand-wringing amongst French vintners. But you know all about it because you read RFI English journalist Jan van der Made's article, France's wine industry is in crisis. Can this Nigerian consultant save it? Chenido Rita Rosa, the CEO of the Bordeaux-based Vin de Rosa, thinks she has the solution. Reread Jan's article, France's wine industry is in crisis. Can this Nigerian consultant save it? And send in the answer to this question. What is Chenido Rita Rosa's solution for the troubled French wine industry? Again, reread Jan van der Made's article, France's wine industry is in crisis. Can this Nigerian consultant save it? And send in the answer to this question. Chenido Rita Rosa, the CEO of the Bordeaux-based consultancy Vin de Rosa, sees a fairly simple solution to the problems besetting France's wine industry, especially that of Bordeaux's. What is it? You'll find Jan's article on the Sound Kitchen page on our website, rfienglish.com, as well as on the Sound Kitchen and the RFI English Listeners Forum Facebook pages. Paul, what's this week's bonus question?
It was suggested by Sadman Shihab Shahorier, who's the co-chairman of the Source of Knowledge Club in Naugaon in Bangladesh. Sadman's question is, what is your most vivid childhood memory? Amongst all your memories, which is the one that stands out the most?
Baby brother, tell.
I didn't have a childhood.
Stop it.
It were rough. We went straight into the mines. It wasn't a childhood.
Okay.
But when I emerged from the mines, I would say, childhood, does nine count as childhood? 9 years old?
Yeah, of course.
All right. In which case, nine. I went with my mum and my sister from London to Stuttgart to visit my mum's friend Siggy. And we had to go on the train from London, and then we went on the boat, and then we went on this night train from the Hook of Holland down to Stuttgart. And I think it was the first time I'd been abroad. And so we had to have passports and everything, and we were in a sleeper on the train. And then I remember distinctly going through Aachen, and because I remember the lights. And I think it went past the train might have gone past the cathedral, and I just remember the cathedral being lit up, or something was lit up anyway. It was all weird. And then obviously the passport checks, and they wouldn't just open the doors, they'd seem to rip open the doors, you know, so they'd make this huge noise. And I thought it was just like being in one of those war films, because it was about 1970s, being brought up on British war, Second World War films. It was just, you know, and then Deutsche Passkontrolle coming in, you know. So I thought, yeah, I'm in one of those war films. But that was one of my memories. And we got to Stuttgart, and we got there, got off the train, so it was a bit late, and my mum said, "Is this Stuttgart?" And this guy said, this train guard said, "Jawohl," because we were in Germany. So we're in Germany. I don't know if we're in Stuttgart. And we were all kind of taken back by his direct approach. And we proceeded to have about 2 or 3 weeks not in Stuttgart, but around Germany with Siggy and getting introduced to her family. And that went on. And I must say, 9 years later, I went back to Germany because I was studying German for A-level. And I stayed with Siggy's aunt and uncle. Uncle Jupp and Tante Reise, and it was brilliant. So that childhood memory became something more, and that was one of the big memories of my teens, which I suppose is childhood now that I'm so old. and they just loved it, because they saw me as a nine-year-old boy who couldn't speak a word of German, and 9 years later I was able to sit down and have chats with them because I was learning German.
Right.
And they spoke Hochdeutsch to me because they were from Schwabenland, and so they didn't speak Schwäbisch at home, and helped me get through my A-levels with my spoken German. And obviously when I was studying German about 3 years later at university, I went from Tübingen down to see them in where they live, Schwäbisch Gmünd, around there. And they were thrilled. They were thrilled, obviously, from seeing this 9-year-old boy, 21-year-old, who still took the time to come out and see them.
You're such a good boy. That was your mama raised you right.
Yeah, well, I was told to actually phone up Siggy for her 80th birthday only last week.
Okay.
So the connection still goes on. That's childhood memories.
Oh,
there you go.
That's a nice one. That's a nice one.
Yeah, and you?
Well, mine is far more pedestrian. I should say aviatic. Because it is, I was very little, I think maybe 5. Mm. And it's of my dad holding me by the hands and spinning around and around. So that when the kids' feet come off the ground. That's why I said it's not pedestrian, it's aviatic.
And your mother is supposed to be nearby saying, "Hold on,
No, it was the last of 4. She was like, but he was singing to me Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. I still love that song.
That's nice.
And when I was thinking about this, I went and listened to it again.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'm pop. Bon. What about you? What is your most vivid childhood memory? Remember, we're always happy to hear your ideas for bonus questions, so please send them in. You have until the 21st of April to get your answers to the quiz and the bonus question in. Be sure to tune in on the 26th of April to hear if your answer wins a prize. As always, be sure you include your postal address with your postal code. And don't forget to let me know if you are a Miss, a Ms., a Mrs., or a Mr. I don't want to get it wrong.
Send your quiz answers to english.service@rfi.fr. That's english.service@rfi.fr. Always include your postal mailing address, and if you have one, your RFI Club membership number.
This is the Sound Kitchen.
Sound Kitchen.
And Susan Owensby's cooking.
And now, more from and about you. It's time for the Listener's Corner. Take it away, baby brother.
The question you answered this week was, what was the breaking point that made you quit a job? Let's start with Radhakrishna Pillai, who wrote, I quit my job as a journalist at the Malayalam Daily when I got a job in the public relations department for the government of Kerala. It was a better job, more varied, with opportunities to learn new things. Ditto for Helmut Matt, who wrote, I quit twice because other companies paid far better. Lack of opportunity is what led Jayanta Chakrabarty to quit, and this is what he wrote. There was not one, but several pertinent reasons for quitting my job. After working for some time in my first job, I found out that there were no new skills to learn and thus opportunities for further growth in the organisation were limited. Moreover, I wanted to balance my work and personal life in a better way. With my qualifications, I was sure to find a better position, so I bid goodbye to my job. Father Stephen Wara wrote, I have never turned my back on a job, but assuming I were to, it would likely be for the reason my boss refused to pay 6 months' accrued salary.
Father Steve, that would definitely be a good reason for quitting. Nasir Muhammad has never quit a job either and has this advice to offer. I always advise people against quitting jobs because of someone's attitude or behavior towards them, because if they quit, that person would be happy. Nasir, Paul and I looked at each other with that, he has a point look when we heard your, when we read your answer.
I stay to make them unhappy. that's the idea. And start doing little things. Okay. Won't go into those secrets today, but my wife knows them all. Anyway, Amir Jamil wrote, it's always difficult to leave a job where you give the best years of your life. There are many factors, but most importantly, the stressful environment, undervaluation, and the unappreciative behaviour of management. My concerns were not addressed, and that's when I made my decision. That's what led Kashif Khalil to quit, he wrote. The overburden and the stress given from my employer was what made me quit my first job. Dipita Chakrabarty wrote, I quit my job in a music school, which I joined out of my passion for music. Initially, it was quite interesting, but after 3 years of giving my best, I became frustrated. There was no teamwork or effort by management to impart quality training to the students. I had to always use the same syllabus, and I thought the students were being cheated. They learned no new topics to improve their skills or creativity. It was morally wrong to continue in the music school. Hijab Abid left her job to start her own business, cattle farming. She wrote that it was an excellent decision for her. We'll end with Salim Akhtar Chadha, who has this advice, not for quitting, but for how to get fired from a job. Do your work at the speed of a tortoise. Don't listen to the boss. and fly kites on the roof of your office. Apply for leave every week and demand loans every day. I'm hesitating because I'm going at the speed of a tortoise to see if I get fired from the sound kitchen.
Sorry, no chance. You're stuck. You're stuck.
It doesn't work, you see. No. It doesn't work. And there you have it. Remember, everyone, this week's bonus question suggested by Sadman Shihab Shahorier from Naugan in Bangladesh is, what is your most vivid childhood memory? Do you have a bonus question idea? Well, if so, send it to us at the Sound Kitchen, all one word, no spaces, at rfi.fr.
That's it for today's Listener's Corner. Thanks, everyone, for participating. And a special thanks to Paul Myers for hanging out in the kitchen with us and not flying kites in the studio.
I should have said that more slowly. Thank you. A pleasure.
Hello, everyone. I am Umman from Pakistan, and you are listening to the Sound Kitchen on Radio France International.
Okay, my friends, it's time to clear the table and wash the dishes. Thanks for joining us in the Sound Kitchen, and keep those cards, letters, and emails coming. Many, many thanks to our sound engineer, Erwan Rome, for his input and his expertise in putting the show together, and thanks to you for listening. Be sure and tune in next week, April 5th, for the answer to the question about the European Union's approach to artificial intelligence. The Sound Kitchen podcast is ready for you every Saturday on the RFI English website, rfienglish.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll play you out with music from Erwan, our sound engineer, who's also a musician. This week, Erwan chose music performed by a 2-time Grammy winner, saxophonist Gary Bartz. The piece Erwan chose for us is called Giant Steps from Bartz's 1978 album, Love Affair. Bartz, born in 1940 in Baltimore, is the son of the owners of a jazz nightclub. Not too surprising, he was called to music. Bartz studied at the renowned Juilliard School of Music in New York and immediately began to work with some of the era's most distinguished jazz musicians, McCoy Tyner, Charlie Mingus, Art Blakey, Miles Davis, and went on to win 2 Grammy Awards for Best Latin Jazz Performance in 1998 and for Best Jazz Instrumental Album, Individual or Group, in 2005. He's currently professor of saxophone at Oberlin College and Conservatory. As noted, Erwan chose Bartz's performance of Giant Steps. Giant Steps, a jazz standard, was written by John Coltrane in 1959 and is known as one of the most feared songs in jazz because of its challenging chord structure. I think there's no fear here. It's all perfectly mastered and added to. You'll hear the Brazilian influence in Bartz's arrangement, the violins and the samba. So here it is, Giant Steps by John Coltrane, performed by Gary Bartz. Thank you, Erwan, for another musical journey. I'm Susan Owensby. Be well, do good work, be kind, and stay in touch. And remember, do not confuse human beings, our brothers and sisters, with their governments. Stay safe, my friends, and be a blessing. Be a rainbow in someone's cloud. Talk to you all next week.